Hello, everybody. So this is going to be a bit of an archaeological presentation. It's not really an Osmocom developer talk per se. It could be seen as maybe like a retro networking talk, but because it's GSM, figured, okay, it's going to be here. So, you know, the slide here, this is just introduction, what we're going to cover, so you can read it. So now let's dive in. So the history of TI's involvement in GSM chipset business goes actually way back. It goes back to the time of those legendary DCT-3 phones by Nokia. So, you know, I figure most people in the phone hacking scene, you know, particularly GSM phone hacking scene, are probably very familiar, have a lot of fond memories of the Nokia DCT-3 platform, which chronologically was long before FreeCalypso, long before Osmocom, long before most other things. You know, DCT-3 goes way back. But what some people may not realize is that the chip in those DCT-3 phones was actually made by TI, and it was the symbiotic relation between Nokia and TI that started all of it. So they. In those days, Nokia was, you know, the big leader in GSM. They certainly were leader in the handset business. I don't know if they also had a foot in infrastructure, BTS business, maybe. Oh, yeah, of course. There are the Nokia base stations. So they had a foot in that realm, too. And but in those days, we're talking mid to late 1990s, TI were the leaders in DSPs and digital signal processing. So they had the flagship DSP of that day. And so somewhere Nokia and TI got together and decided that they were going to form this symbiotic relationship with TI, fabbing this custom chip for Nokia, which had TI's flagship DSP at that time. So I don't know if the chip in DCT-3, I've seen it referred to as MAD, and I've also seen it referred to as MAD-2. So I'm not exactly sure which is the exact designation. This is like pretty deep archaeology here. But it did have an F number. It was F73 something, which was TI's fab designation for pretty much any kind of custom Skunkworks chip that they would do in those days. And that it also appears to be how the ARM7 TDMI core came into the picture. So it looks like Nokia may have pulled the strings for TI to become a licensee to the ARM cores from ARM, the company. Lots of people say even some press release from ARM themselves says that Nokia 6110 was the first GSM phone with an ARM processor, with ARM being ARM7 TDMI, which, and we also know that 6110 was the first DCT-3 phone. And if we look at in the ancient service manual for those phones that has schematics and basic part list, you'll see that this MAD chip or MAD2, whatever it's called, it also has a number, begins with F73 something, which is very obviously a TI Skunkworks fab number. So, and inside the chip, there was the DSP, which, you know, was a very, very, very old predecessor of the one that eventually got into Calypso, and the ARM7 TDMI core. I mean, everything else was different. You know, the chipset in those Nokia phones was nothing like familiar Calypso. It's a much, much older. Everything else was very different. But I think TI only made just this chip. Everything else was Nokia's own ASICs. But the two process architecture with ARM7 TDMI and that led to DSP, that's where that originates. So that's the beginning. And this is the end. How TI eventually got out of this business. Now, as far as the why, well, you know, the motivations, business world, profitability and whatnot, that's not my domain, not my department. But in terms of chronology, when it happened and how it happened, it appears to have been somewhere between 2009 and 2012, with 2012 being the final exit. And how do I know that 2012 was the year when they fully exited? Actually, I found a press release, or maybe not a press release, more like an article in online newspaper, some kind of news site from France. Now, my French is very, very rusty. I took a little bit of it, but kind of went in one ear out the other. But thankfully, that particular article was in English, so I could easily read it. And it was like Riviera News or something. So the area where TI operated, it was this town called Villeneuve-Loubet, sorry for my pronunciation, in Région de Nice in France. So the Nice area, that is where they had their whole infrastructure. They had a big, huge development center, at least, possibly even a fab. You know, the area was also known as the French Riviera. It was also known as Côte d'Azur. Again, sorry, I'm probably butchering that pronunciation-wise. But anyway, there was an article from 2012 from a local online newspaper in that area that was lamenting the closure of the facility, the closure, complete total closure of the facility with everybody laid off, some really, really large number of people. And they were saying how the facility goes back decades, back to the days when TI made, you know, giant calculators and stuff, long before, you know, the GSM stuff. But in 2012, it all came to the end, the whole place closed. And we know that's where all of the GSM development happened. It was at that office. So all that shut down in 2012. And also, this last paragraph I put in there, what I find so strange is over the years, as I was trying, I made so many repeated attempts to reach out to TI. You know, I tried talking to TI about, you know, getting them to release, you know, their firmware more under some kind of legitimate license. I tried, you know, see if we could convince them to dig in their archives to find, you know, some more materials that we don't have. You know, just try to approach them from so many different angles. And the response I kept always getting was, it's like it doesn't exist. I say, well, what are you talking about? No such TI product has ever existed, seems to be the most common response. So it's almost like they want the whole world to forget that that business ever existed at all. Completely erase the history, giant memory hole amnesia. So, you know, again, I'm not familiar with the European culture, so I would take this park as a joke, maybe. So I don't know if GDPR applies to companies or not. But that's kind of how, yeah, it's like they're exercising the right to be forgotten, it seems. So that was the end of TI. Now let's see, this slide I'm not gonna go over in detail because probably a little too off topic for this community here, but you can read it later. You can read it later at your leisure, definitely post it. So when they were active, what was it that they actually did? So, you know, we covered how they started, how it all started, the symbiotic relation with TI, you know, with Nokia. And so, but then they had, you know, so many other chips that they made. So there was, let's see. They had the digital baseband chips, they had the analog baseband chips, they had RF chips, and they had this whole evolutionary line. And the Calypso that we are playing with here was just one somewhat arbitrary point on that evolutionary line. It was nowhere close to the first and also nowhere close to the last. And, you know, they also made development boards, maintained reference firmware. So, pretty much, you know, you can read all of that. So here it becomes reasonable to ask if TI had such a long evolutionary line, if they had so many other chipsets that came before Calypso, and they also had, you know, like they had Hercules, they had Ulysse, those were all before Calypso, and then they had the later chips, they had Locosto, they had eCosta, which apparently, you know, the E was for Edge. So why is the GSM hacker community playing with Calypso? Why not any of the earlier chips or any of the later ones? Like, what makes Calypso so special when there is really nothing special about it? And unfortunately, I don't have an answer to this question, at least not any kind of complete answer. All I have is, you know, partial answers. So for me personally, you know, I say it like it is. For me, it was all about equality. I just wanted the same thing that Open Mocha had. Wouldn't accept anything less. And, you know, in the case of AsmoconDB, I'm not the right person to comment, but again, you can follow up on that point. So let's see. Okay. Someone says Calypso is the last one without security features, secure boot. Yes. Thank you for that comment. You are correct with this one, although only partially correct. So in the case of secure boot features, there was a chip that was right after the Calypso called Calypso Plus. And the Calypso Plus actually had two versions. It had the secure version and a non-secured version. And the official development board for Calypso Plus was eSample. I don't really have a slide for that one in this presentation, but I'll get to it. So eSample was actually made in two versions, apparently. Well, it was different versions of the chip. So there was a chip with security and without security. I don't know if it was a fuse or what. But also, according to TI's official documentation for their Fluid program, their flash loader and the utility independent of device, if you had a non-secure eSample, if you had an eSample board or the Calypso Plus chip that did not have the security enabled, that also meant it didn't have that nice, pleasant, convenient boot ROM that we have on regular Calypso, the boot ROM that makes the flash unbreakable. With the eSample, you couldn't have that. With eSample and Calypso Plus, you either had the secure boot, you know, restricted, or you would have a non-secure one, you would have no boot ROM at all. And if you have no boot ROM at all, that means if your flash was blank or bricked, the only way to do a cold load was through JTAG. But anyway, so back to what, you know, I was originally planning to talk on were the different versions of the Calypso chip. So even, you know, this is not concerning Calypso Plus. This is just regular Calypso. It went through quite a few revisions, because if you look at the PDFs, you know, the PDFs that we have leaked, whatever you want to call them, the official data sheets, registered documents, they have at the beginning of the document, they have the revision history, it has revision numbers and dates. And you can see how the earliest dates are all around year 2000. So around year 2000 is when they started the program, when they made all the key design decisions for what is going to be part of Calypso and what won't be. All those design decisions were basically set in around 2000, whereas the phones that most people, most people here, at least not more calm community, think of a Calypso phone. You guys are probably thinking, what, like Motorola C1 XX, which would be around 2005. So we have this 5-year gap essentially between the original initial design of the chip and the final version. So here I cover what were some of the changes that happened. oh, this is so interesting by Harald's comment. You can find press releases as stated in 2000. They hired 200 engineers in that TI. Yep, okay, so 200 people. Thank you, Harald, for the comment. Very interesting. So, yep, it must have been that same place in Nice, Villeneuve-Loubert. So they were working on that thing. The original Calypso, the first version that they came out with, they also had these designations like the CO5, CO35. I never found any mapping of, thanks for the link, of how those designations correspond to actual nanometers or micrometers of whatever, the physical transistor sizes in those days. But they did have those designations, with CO5 being bigger, older, and CO35 being newer, smaller, that we do know. So the first Calypso was CO5 by their designation. It was the CO5 revision A. I don't have that one. I only have revision B. It was the oldest one that I have. But, looking at documentation, look at TI's firmware source code, looking at all those things, we kind of know a little bit about CO5 Rev A, because there's actually an errata document, which we happen to have amongst the collection. There's an errata document that describes all the bugs that were present in CO5 Rev A, which were fixed in CO5 Rev B or later CO35. And in the original firmware source, you can find in a few places workarounds for those bugs, conditionally compiled based on chipset 7, which was the internal number for it. And also, there was something called Samsung. So it looks like Samsung was a predecessor to Calypso. And I don't have a very clear understanding of what the Samsung chip was like. There's no documentation, but it looks like it was the RAM-based version. So when they were building, when they were designing the Calypso, they knew it was going to have two ROMs. They knew it was going to have a DSP ROM, and they knew it was going to have a boot ROM. But it looks like Samsung was a prototype chip, probably made an extremely small run, where it had RAM instead of ROM in both places, both for the boot part and for the DSP part. And apparently it was meant for development. I mean, I find it strange that they actually went through Fabian and ASIC. And my understanding is that the Fabian ASIC, it's impossible to make just a few pieces. The smallest possible production run you could make with an ASIC is already some ginormous number, but again, not really something I'm too familiar with. I find it interesting nonetheless that they had this prototype chip. But yeah, then they had this, they had this Calypso CO5, and they had this much older DSP ROM version, which we happen to have a dump of. And so this DSP ROM 3311, it did not have AMR. It was a much, much older, I'll talk about AMR later. And also, it's interesting to note that the legendary TSM30, which, obviously very famous in the phone hacking community. It's a legend because I've never seen it with my own eyes. As far as I know, the only person in the world who actually has a TSM30 phone is Dieter Spahr. So I don't know if anyone else on the planet who has a TSM30 phone. But according to documentation and study in the legendary TSM30 source, we can tell that it was Calypso CO5 Rev, a very old version of Calypso, and on C sample too. Wow, Steve says you can still get them on eBay Spain about the... Okay, well, I'm going to address that part after we end the recording. So when it comes to the official TI development boards, the Calypso CO5 Rev A only appeared on C-sample. D-sample never had CO5-REV-A, it only had CO5-REV-B. And so CO5-REV-B, it is still CO5, it still requires 1.8 volt core voltage, it still has the lower clock frequency. Clock frequency. So Calypso CO5, the DSP clock, it maxes out, I believe, at either 78 or 95, either 78 or 91 megahertz. I'm not sure. One of those two is the clock limit for the DSP. And for the ARM part, the clock frequency limit is 39 megahertz. Whereas on CO35, they raised the maximum clock frequency. Now the DSP runs at 104 and the ARM runs at 52. So CO5-REV-B, it is still CO5, it is still limited to the older clock frequency, lower clock frequencies. It still has the 1.8 volt core voltage, which became 1.5 and then later one. And it still has absolutely no AMR, no possibility of AMR, but it did fix a lot of bugs. And so CO5-REV-B, I do have that one, which I'll cover. And then you know, we come to the CO35, which is the one that everybody actually plays with that in real phones. And even with CO35, you had multiple revisions based on the DSP ROM. So supposedly there were really early ones with 3311, then there was DSP ROM 3416, and finally 3606. So the very, very final version with 3606, that is the one that we all play with. All of our new readily available development boards from FreeCalypso and others, all of the Motorola phones, all of those devices, it's all CO35 DSP version 3606. That's what they all have. So let's see. So this is another thing. Some people have expressed a misconception about GPRS because it, at least in the Smartcom community, the most popular model of Calypso phone seems to be the low-end C1XX, like all of your C123s and C115s and C129s. And officially, all of those phones, they were all officially shipped without GPRS support. So some people developed a misconception that perhaps the Calypso Lite chip in those phones is non-GPRS capable. That is not true. The exact same chip, the exact same Calypso Lite chip that appears in those phones, it has also been used in other products which do officially support GPRS. Motorola C155, C156 with the same chip officially supports GPRS. Huawei GTM 900, iWOW TR800, which I'll cover, those modules, again, they were officially shipped with GPRS support. And yeah, same Calypso Lite chip. So on a chip level, the only difference is just the size of internal RAM. That in Calypso Lite, they made the internal RAM smaller. That's it, literally nothing else. And you know, as far as the lack of GPRS on the Motorola phones, that was just Motorola's design decision. They said, okay, this is a low-end product, we're not going to do GPRS. And if you remove GPRS, if you compile the firmware, official firmware with GPRS removed, the size of it becomes a lot smaller, and so they could use smaller flash, smaller external RAM. So that's all it is, nothing with the chip itself. And so AMR, yes. AMR is really interesting, and it is a lot of it is still a mystery even to me with all of the new work that I've done all the years of studying. So for what I can tell is this, is that with the earlier DSP ROM versions, if you have a Calypso CO5 with DSP ROM 3311, or perhaps even super early CO35 with DSP ROM 3311, if such a thing existed, if you have one of those chip versions, it is impossible to add AMR. There are no downloadable DSP patches that add AMR support. And so I'm reasonably sure that it's impossible to add, because if it were possible, I'm sure TI would have added it, because they did always, you know, every official firmware version that TI ever released, they always apply some kind of DSP patches. So if adding AMR was just all a matter of the patches, they would have done it, but they didn't. So there is definitely something in the newer ROMs in the 3416 and 3606 ROMs. There is something in them that already adds at least partial support for AMR. Now, it might be incomplete. I've done some very, very cursory brief tests, you know, taking official TCS211 firmware and just disabling the DSP patch loading just to see what happens. And I didn't test it very much, and it was quite a few years ago, so my memory is a little fuzzy. But from what I remember, AMR calls worked, or at least appeared to work in my very, very brief testing. There may have been some instability. It may be one of those things where it would crash under certain conditions. But it was mostly there. So it seems like it's probably just a matter of some bugs, and the DSP downloadable patches probably fix some bugs here and there. That's most likely. But the other big mystery that I still have is, why did they make yet another silicon revision going from 3416 to 3606? Now, we know that the change from 3311 to 3416, we know that change was the addition of AMR. But why did they then make yet another silicon revision with all of the associated costs and yet another version of the mask ROM 3606, which, you know, the comments in the little XML configuration file of the firmware build, it says that reworked firmware version. And can't really tell what. And I mean, we do have dumps. So as far as ESP dumps, so in AsmacMBB there is this little program. I'm guessing it was Sylvain who put together this custom patch that allows the DSP to be read out. So I took that little program, I ported it into the FreeCalypso universe to make it easier to run on other non-OBB supported platforms. And using that tool, I actually have posted dumps on my FTP site from all three versions. I have a dump from DSP ROM 3311. That came from the D-sample board. I have a dump from 3416. And how did I get that? I actually bought some Calypso chips with 3416, the DSP ROM 3416 on them. I had my people, my board assemble people, populate that chip onto an FCDF3B with a BGA reworkstation, and then doing the X-ray inspection to make sure that the solder joints under the BGA actually made correctly. And so I have this one FCDF3B with this modified Calypso chip on it with 3416 DSP. So I used that board to make a dump of the DSP. And I also did run some tests. I tested very briefly, and again, it appeared to be working. You know, with the official patches from TI corresponding to 3416, it looked like the AMR was working, but so I don't know why they had to make another version. But also another thing that's a little non-obvious is about DTX. So in GSM, on the BTS side, the network side, you can only enable DTX if you have multiple ARFCNs. If you only have a single ARFCN, then in the downlink, you cannot enable TRX. But in the uplink, DTX is always allowed, always desired, because you want to save battery in the handset. But as it turns out, on plain Calypso, as opposed to Lacoste or later ones, there is no working DTX for AMR. So if you're using an older plain codec, then it does support DTX. But if you are in AMR mode, it will turn on a transmitter on every burst. Every TDMA frame, it will always transmit a burst. There is no mechanism there to do AMR DTX, which I guess is a bit more complicated than DTX for other codecs. So that's actually another reason why I run my Themyscira wireless network at home with EFR as opposed to AMR, because of this little quirk with DTX. So let's see. Additional required chips. So everything we've covered so far is just the main chip, is just the DBB, digital baseband. But you also need this analog baseband, and you also need RF. So when it comes to the analog baseband with Calypso, you have two choices. The original official combination was Calypso plus Nausicaa. And then later they made the Yota chip, which replaces Nausicaa. But Nausicaa was used on the C-sample and on the TSM-30. So I know, so Steve said that you've got the TSM-30. Well, then you have a system that has Calypso CO5 revision A plus Nausicaa ABB, which is the same baseband as C-sample, from what I can tell. And also, Nausicaa can put out 5 volts toward the SIM. Even though the power to the whole arrangement comes from a single lithium-ion cell or 3 NIMH cells, so there isn't enough input voltage in the battery to make 5 volts. So you have to do some kind of boost converter, I'm guessing probably a charge pump. And of course, you know, charge pump boost converters are pretty inefficient in terms of energy. So they prefer that you have a SIM card that operates at a lower voltage. But Nausicaa still supports 5 volt only SIM cards, in which case will boost the voltage up to 5 volts. And that's only on Nausicaa. On Yota, you can't do it anymore. So Nausicaa is 3 volt and 5 volt toward the SIM. Yota is either 3 volt or 1.8 volt. So, Yota was used from D-sample onward, like I mentioned, and everything that, you know, our current projects play with is all Yota, never even found a data sheet for the Nausicaa. So, and then we get to RF transceiver. So when it comes, the coupling between the digital baseband and the analog baseband, the DBB to ABB coupling, that's very, very vendor specific. That's a very TI proprietary coupling. But in those days, the interface to the RF transceiver was the analog INQ. And that was actually enough of an industry standard to where you could pick different vendors. So TI's own RF chips were first Clara, and then they had Rita. And apparently, Clara, the one they used on the sample, was really inconvenient to use. It required a lot of external components. And TI were kind of slow, kind of late with coming out with the Rita chip. And so a lot of vendors ended up going with a hybrid chipset. Quite a few devices, you know, phones and modems were made where the chipset was TI, Calypso plus Yota, but the RF transceiver was Silicon Labs Aero. You know, the Scilabs Aero family was very, very popular. They had Aero 1, which was in the TSM-30, and they had Aero 1 Plus, which was in BenQ M32. Then they had Aero 2, which Aero 2 is really nice. It's only 5x5 millimeter, very small physical form factor. So that went into quite a few designs. And now, thank you, Harold, for letting me know about DigiRF. That was something I did not know about before, but in one of the previous calls that was mentioned. And so I researched a lot about the DigiRF. So that was a later idea. TI, apparently, as far as I can tell, never did DigiRF. They had, at first, they had the older paradigm where the interoperable intervendor thing was the analog INQ. And then later, when they went to Locosta, they just put everything in one chip. But Locosta, you have the baseband and RF all in one chip, so there's no more interface. But apparently, other vendors had this DigiRF thing where they had the intervendor, mostly interoperable interface between baseband and RF chips that was digital as opposed to analog. But again, you know, thank you, Harold, for letting me know about it. But TI never got into it. They just didn't. So yeah, TI had some very special voodoo to build the RFIC. Yeah, they could build the RFIC in-house. Yeah, that's true, because RFIC is such a different domain of expertise. Yep. Yeah, most of the digital, indeed, yes, like Skyworks and RFMD, and Scilabs. So, yeah, TI, indeed, that was kind of unusual for them to first come out with first the Clara, then the Rita, and even before Clara, they had some others. They had some Pascal, Sarah, not really familiar with those. I wasn't able to tell if Pascal and Sarah code names, if those were also TI made RF chips, or if they were just code names that they applied to a chip they took from somewhere else. I wasn't able to figure this part out. But at least from Clara onward, they made their own RF chips. That much we know. So let's see what we've got. Yeah, so now here I'm covering basically why they were doing the way they had to do things. So as people in the past, like, you know, 10 years ago or more, were asking questions like, well, why did they have to be so bundled, the chipset plus the firmware plus all that stuff? Why couldn't they just make chips and let the community take care of software or something like that? But now imagine you are the chipset vendor. Imagine you, any one of you here, was in the business of making GSM chipsets. So you made a chip. How do you even know that your chip works? So you can do some like basic test vectors, but how do you know that it works under stress? How do you know that it has a sufficient horsepower to handle every possible corner case, and that in full real life operation, you'll never run into an issue like some overheat somewhere, or some silicon bug that only gets tickled when you run the full protocol stack and not otherwise? The only way you can ever know that your chip is actually working is if you build the whole thing. So you have to produce not only the chipset, but you produce the chip, you produce the development board that the chip goes onto, and then you produce the official reference firmware that runs on the development board. You have to have all of those pieces. Otherwise, you don't even know if your chip really works. So that's kind of what TI did back in those days. But unfortunately, there is the destructive nature of man. So, just like all the Sumerian clay tablets and what Egyptian scrolls and whatnot, so much has been lost. So, a lot of the official firmware, it looks like there is only one surviving version. At least there was only one surviving version I could find of it that exists anywhere. And so, once I kind of stepped into the shoes, decided to take over TI's old business, I'm really not doing anything different from what they were doing. So again, I don't need to go into detail, but it's really no innovation. The same thing TI did, I'm doing the same thing now. Chips, development boards and firmware, that's all it is. So development board. This is the earliest TI historical development board that I was able to find a picture of. I have reason to believe that this board is C-sample, but as a disclaimer, I don't have proof. I don't know with absolute 100% certainty that this board is indeed C-sample. It might be a different TI board, but based on all the circumstantial evidence, I suspect that it is probably C-sample. So where did this picture come from? The photo that's on the slide. This little JPEG was extracted from a marketing PDF by TI from ages ago. So TI had a few slide decks that they would give in presentations just like this one. And they had, this particular photo, this particular JPEG was extracted out of the Riviera presentation. And Riviera was a software-oriented presentation, not hardware-oriented. And so they were presenting to software developers, telling them, look how you can develop your software on a PC, on Windows, of course, all proprietary crap, and then how you could land ported to your final target. And they had a cute little slide, little diagram in their slide where it showed on the left side, it showed the PC development environment. Then they showed a little arrow pointing to the right. And then they had a picture of a board. And the picture of the board was the one I'm showing. So whoever put together that slide, they just wanted to show some board. They didn't care which one. But studying this photo, it looks like it's a C-sample. And unfortunately, it's very, very low resolution. The JPEG image embedded inside the PDF by TI, I forget the exact number of pixels, but very, very small resolution, but we can still make out a few details. So what are the things, what are the telltale signs here? The first telltale sign is we look at the display size. This display size seems consistent with, because we know from software, from studying the original firmware source, that the LCD on C-sample was 84 by 48 pixels, black and white, which, by the way, is the exact same display size as on old Nokia DCT3 phones. So why did TI use a display size on a development board's LCD size that's exactly same as Nokia DCT3? I'm guessing because they still had the symbiotic relation between the two companies in those days. And so it probably was, in fact, Nokia's display, most likely. And so the next thing we'll look at is the keypad. Notice the layout of the keypad in this photo. And if you compare this keypad layout to the keypad on, say, a Pirelli DPL10 or a Motorola C1XX phone, any one of those, you will notice that there is only one difference. The only difference is these two buttons right here. So on the board that we see in the photo, we see an up arrow and a down arrow. Whereas on all the Motorola C1XX and Pirelli DPL10, we see a five-way navigation with left, right, up, down, and center. And looking at TI's firmware source, we can see that it was the change from C-sample to D-sample is where they made this transition. So on C-sample, they only had up and down arrow keys, whereas on the D-sample, they introduced the five-way navigation key. So once again, it's consistent with C-sample. Another thing we see here is we see these two UARTs. These are very obviously DE9 connectors. They're very obviously RS-232 ports. And looking at the comments in TI's firmware source in uartfox.c, the comments there say that the serial port UART arrangement on C-sample and D-sample is the same. The comment in the source says C and D-sample, and then it shows a little ASCII art drawing of the pinout. So this, again, is consistent with the evidence. And here, I want to draw your attention to this orange connector. So I know at least a couple people here have my FCDF3B boards, and those who don't have an FCDF3B board have certainly seen what it looks like. And I'm sure people have wondered, where in the world did you get this weird orange connector for the battery power input? Well, that is where it comes from. So this is the earliest TI board I know of that had this type of signature connector. And of course, right next to it is where you hook up the antenna. So, you know, it looks like this is the C-sample board. We don't know for sure, but yeah. So now here is where you can find all the sources. So if anyone wants to do their own forensic analysis of the original JPEGs from TI prior to me messing around with them, you can find them, you know, on these links. And this presentation is that will be posted, so you'll be able to just copy and paste the links. And now we come to the next board. This is my favorite. This is my favorite board of all. take a sip of my drink. This board was called G-Sample. And once again, the photo I'm showing on the slide was also extracted from a TI marketing presentation. But this board I actually have. There's a very slight difference. So this picture that they show here, if you download the raw JPEG and look at it in full resolution, you can make out that it says on the PCB, D-Sample Revision 2. The one that I got physically in my hand is PCB Revision 3, it says on the silk screen. But the only difference I can tell is in this little corner, the Revision 3 has two jumpers added in this corner right here that have something to do with charging. Again, no schematics, so we don't know. But the reason why I decided to pick this photo out of TI's own presentation is they can see how they envisioned it being used. So you can see exactly how they intended the power to be connected. And also, as another little aside, because I wanted to replicate TI's original history so faithfully, when I was doing SDFTB design, so I copied the connector part number for the part that actually goes on the PCB. But what about the mating plug? The plug that's on the cable that inserts into the connector, when I was looking at compatible parts from Weidmüller, I found several different parts that were compatible. So which one I picked, or what I did was, when I was looking at this picture, the same picture you're looking at right now, I was looking at it in full resolution, and I was very closely visually scrutinizing the exact shape and appearance of this plug, comparing it to different ones available from Weidmüller. And I picked a specific part to put on the adapters that I assemble, on the end of the cord. So I picked the specific plug part number, which appears to visually match the one that's in this photo right here. So this photo is the only source of knowledge that I had for deciding exactly which plug to put on the end of the DC output cable from the little power supply adapter. And also in this photo, we can see the picture on the LCD. So unfortunately, the code that displays the picture on CD is gone. It's just like the Sumerian Clay tablets and so many other things. It, you know, just couldn't find the destructive nature of man, couldn't find a surviving copy anywhere. But this appears to have been a hardware test code. In other words, when this photo was taken back in TI in whatever year, the firmware running on the board at that moment was not GSM operational firmware. It was some kind of hardware test code that exercises the peripherals without even bringing up the GSM portion. That's what I can tell. So anyway, and so this photo, once again, is the only thing that survives in the present day that gives us an idea of what that hardware test code looked like. So there's some kind of color bars you can see. And I can't tell what this is, like some kind of bird or something. Again, you're more than welcome to study the photo in full resolution. Decide for yourself what that thing is supposed to be. So for this board, yeah, more about it. So this was the main primary development platform. And I actually have one of those. The one that I got, it dates from 2002. And it has the Calypso chip revision, CO5 revision B, the one, you know, the old one, the one that takes 1.8 volt power and runs at a slower clock frequency. It has no AMR, it has DSP revision 3311. So that's, you know, I used it to dump the DSP ROM and the boot ROM from that old chip version. And they use it heavily. This was like their main primary development platform. And so from what I can tell, it spanned a range of quite a few years. So if the first ones were made around 2002, but it looks like they still kept using the same platform possibly as late as 2007. I'm sure, you know, with the late ones, they populated their latest revision of chipset. They put their latest Calypso CO35 with DSP ROM 3606. I'm sure they put those on the later boards, but the PCB itself apparently stayed the same. Was PCB revision 3 was the one. And so here I give all the specs, so what the chip version supported. So Clara RF, no Rita, just Clara, but, you know, tri-band. You know, the RAM, the flash, you know, everything here. So the ginormous display, the Swan 76.20 pixel, that was, yeah, a 16-bit parallel interface. That's what you saw. And they had the magnetic buzzer. So they show the buzzer. So this component right here, this is the buzzer, and the official firmware depends on the buzzer being there. That's how they made the phone ring when incoming calls was using that buzzer. So they certainly assumed the D-sample platform when they were doing all that. And so this here, once again, you know, the unfortunate situation we have was so little survived. So the board that I have, it came with a firmware image already in its flash. And you can see that where I put the date on it somewhere. Yeah, this is the date. This is the date of the firmware image in the flash, 2002, September 17th. So it's very, very old. A lot of my tools barely work with firmware at all because they changed so many things in the later ones. But I was able to, back in 2016, I was being a very, very naughty girl, and I, because I didn't have my own GSM network back then, and so I actually brought it up live on the real commercial network here of T-Mobile. So I put a commercial operator SIM card into it, through the real antenna, and I brought it up, and I successfully made a CSD call. I distinctly remember making a CSD call from it to this service. We have something called this NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, that, you know, they run the official atomic clocks for the US. And they have this service called ACTS, Automated Computer Time Service. So they have these analog modems hooked up to POTS lines somewhere, and you can dial into those analog modems. And that service is still there today. You can dial into those analog modems, and they give you the official time code that comes directly from the nation's most precise atomic clocks that exist. And so I made a CSD call to that service from this D-sample board, from this ancient 10. And I still have it running now. And most recently, I got it powered up once again, this time on my own Themyscira wireless GSM network, run with Asmacom software to bring us on topic here. And, you know, this board is very old. It does not support AMR. There is no AMR at all with this chipset version. So it has to be EFR. So EF worked with the EFR codec. And maybe someday, once when I update to newer Asmacom CNI software that has CSD support, once again, I will have CSD calls working from this ancient board. But unfortunately, as fun as all that stuff is, I just described, the one thing I'm not able to do is run my own current up-to-date firmware on it, because I'm only missing this one file. Where do I have it here? I have the file name here somewhere. This TPU DRV10.c. This one C file is the only thing that stands in a way before being, because we just don't have that file. The world's only surviving copy of TCS211 firmware, it came from the ruins of OpenMoco, and they were using Rita RF, not Clara, and so they got tpudrv12.obj, which I reverse engineered and reconstructed tpudrv12.c from that obj. But for the tpudrv10, there was nothing. No.c, no.obj. So, and I tried reversing the firmware image that's in the flash, the 2002-09-17 firmware image. I tried reversing it and digging inside the giant image where the UDRV10 code is, tried turning that from disassembly back into C. no success. But I tried. I really tried hard. And the other thing that's really unfortunate is the lack of schematics. So we have no schematics for the board. We don't have a data sheet for Clara RF. So there is no way I could just, you know, write a TPU DRV10 driver myself from scratch because there is no data sheet. And lack of schematics also means that all the peripherals there have such fancy, complicated peripherals, all the stuff that they have on the Chip Select 3, total mystery. Without board schematics, we don't know how any of that stuff works. Yeah, mystery there. So very unfortunate. And, you know, the hardware test code was on post. So, yeah, that's the reality we're in. Moving on from D-sample to TI's next board, Leonardo. So when I first started doing the research for what eventually became Precalypso, I started doing the research phase, gathering documentation, gathering knowledge. I started that back in 2011 when Leonardo was the name that kept popping out everywhere. Everywhere I would go, it would seem like TI's reference platform for the chipset was Leonardo. So people who interacted with me back in those days, back when I, you know, looked very different and everything, you might remember me saying Leonardo. So that's what, you know, was the name. And so from what I could tell, this was a simplified development board. So D-sample was this really fancy thing with the LCD and the keypad and all the bells and whistles. Apparently on Leonardo, they didn't have any of those things. They stripped those peripherals, but we'll see it. No, still more mysteries there. So they stripped all those peripherals. They simplified the board to where it's basically only usable for AT command modem functionality. But they did change the RF chip from Clara to Rita because, you know, they were late with producing the Rita chip. Because Rita was the first chip that was really competitive. Clara was not really marketable because it had all the requirements for extra support components. So in the days when TI's only offering was Clara, most real-life manufacturers would just say, screw it to TI, and they would use a Scilabs Aero transceiver instead. But Rita was the first transceiver from TI that was actually competitive market-wise, the way they could say, look, you don't have to go to Scilabs, you can just have an all TI solution now. And Leonardo board was made to be like the reference platform for this arrangement with Calypso Yota Rita. There were issues, you know, that was the mystery thing. So the biggest issue that I was facing at that time is I searched the world high and low for PCB layout files. Could not find a PCB layout file. Still don't have any for the present day, but did find schematics. But with schematics, I found at least three different versions. So I found three different versions of the schematics. In addition to the three different versions of the schematics, I found other evidence, pictorial and documentary evidence, that there were even more versions out there for which we don't have schematics, which were still different somehow. And so I'm just bewildered here. Oh, I was back then. I was looking at this bewildering array of number of different versions of Leonardo, and I'm thinking, okay, well, what could possible reason did they have to spin out so many different versions of the board? And the only thing I could think of is, well, what if you're trying to make it work? Let's say you spin out a version of the board, it doesn't work. You spin out a different version of the board, hoping it will work a little bit better. Works a little better, but it's still not quite good. So you spin out a third version and so on. Was this what they were doing? That was the only rational explanation I could find. And if that was the situation, then the next question becomes, okay, well, if you don't have official support, if you're just looking at leaked documents, how do we know that this schematic version that I found from some Chinese site, how do we know that this corresponds to the final revision that actually works, as opposed to some earlier revision that didn't work? So the confidence level in the correctness of those schematics was very, very low for me in those days as I was looking at all those Leonardo variants. So, and there is this very interesting photo. So this photo, once again, comes from a marketing presentation by TI. I have never seen an actual physical Leonardo board with my own eyes. In all the years I've been doing this project, I've been wanting to find it. I've so been wanting to get my hands on a real physical Leonardo board, or at least get an actual photo from someone who actually has one. But no, never found one. The only photo that exists is this weird one from a TI marketing presentation. And this variant, the board variant you see in this photo, does not exactly correspond to any of the available schematic versions. It is slightly different. But you can see very obviously that they were trying to make a handset prototype. So the shape of it, the shape of the board, it was very obvious that this shape is intended to go into a plastic case for a real handset. So, and also notice the unpopulated components. Now, I'm going to assume here that the board that's in the photo was, in fact, physically produced. I mean, of course, we don't know because, you know, TI could have photoshopped it, but, you know, why would they photoshop a board? Because that's really stretching it. So if we assume that this board was physically produced and at some point the board physically existed exactly as depicted here, notice the peculiarity. Notice that the SIM socket is unpopulated. Also, where's the power supply to this board? I can only guess that these unpopulated pads right here, they might be the battery connector with the spring contacts. Maybe that's why it was meant to go. But again, why is it unpopulated? How are they going to power this thing? So the answer comes, obviously, this. And you can see here that there are traces on inner layers that connect to this. And in some of their schematics, I found the pinout for this connector. And looking at the pinout, we can see that on this connector, they have power, they have battery power. They have boot control signals, power on and reset. They have the SIM interface signals, and they have at least one UART. So given that those signals are present on this interface, if they had some kind of test fixture that this would plug into, then they could see how, if this board was in fact physically produced exactly like it's depicted here, that indeed they could have made the board up and running. And for the RF, you know, I can't tell if this is one of those RF test ports like they have on commercially produced phones that you would use for calibration and whatnot. So they probably used that to actually bring this up. So it's plausible that this board may have been physically produced and it did work. And also another little detail is if you look at this photo in full resolution and look at the markings on the Calypso chip, and you have to really squint looking at those markings because it's, once again, a low resolution photo, but it you can make out that it's actually Calypso CO5 revision B, same as on my D-sample board. So once again, we can tell from that that it's a very early one. And also the PA. The PA is the Anadigix one. For Leonardo design, TI started with the Anadigix PA and then later migrated through RFMD, RF3133, which is pin compatible. So the pinout is exactly the same between this Anadigix PA here and RF3133. But it looks like you started with the Anadigix one in the earlier days. So we know we're looking at a really old Leonardo variant. So, but more mysteries. As you can tell by now, this is totally an archaeological presentation here. I'm digging through the mysteries of TI history just like as if I was Indiana Jones. So the big mystery here was what kind of work did they actually do on those boards? Because the one that we just saw the picture of, it looks like, again, it was very obviously intended to go into a plastic case. But did they ever actually make the plastic case? We know they made the board. And they probably, you know, brought it up at least somewhat. But did they go as far as finishing the plastic case and showing it off at trade shows and whatnot. Did they ever do that? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. We just don't have the knowledge. But we also do know that they had a different version of Leonardo, which I'm going to show. And for that one, I have to turn on screen sharing. Let's see if this works. Let's see if we can do this successfully. Okay, I have to click this. All right. Now, hopefully you can see what I'm sharing right now. So this is, let's see. This right here is another, this is a PDF. The PDF is on my FTP site from the first 10 pages in this PDF are schematics, but the last two pages in the PDF are very obviously have been extracted from a PCB layout program. I'm guessing they used pads from what I can tell. So apparently this was an export from pads of what you typically call a component placement drawing. So you can see here, the board is a lot more rectangular. You can see the antenna connector like you would have on a development board as opposed to the little RF test board. So you see a proper antenna connector on this version. Then you see right here, this is very obviously the PCB footprint for that big orange weight mirror connector, the same one that's on C sample, D sample. And yes, that is where I copied the idea for FCD3B. It came from here. And the capacitor, if you look at the picture of the FCD3B, you will see that there is this bright red or orange capacitor that's really big, you know, a 1000 UF tantalum capacitor. This is the footprint for it, so that's where it comes from. You can see those components here, and you can see the SIM socket, which was obviously the same part as on the sample. You see the power on and reset buttons. You see the JTAG connector, and then these are RJ style jacks where they brought the two UARTs at RS-232. Sorry, they're not RS-232. In this board, there is no RS-232. These are native LVC MOS low voltage 2.8 volt UARTs from Calypso, two of them brought out like this. And then, and here, you can see it here, but on the other side, it shows the pinout of that same thing that I'll show you here. Here you can see that they have this edge connector. So this is obviously a different version of Leonardo. So I'm going to switch back to, all right. So this other version, the one for which the component placement drawing that I just shared with all of you, that is the only surviving evidence we have of that other Leonardo board existing. I've never seen a picture of it, never seen a real board. But it looks like that's what they probably used when TI's support division would support customers like FIC, OpenMarket. That's probably the board that they used, I can only reason. But again, just mysteries multiply is, did they ever have, did they ever do any kind of UI development, for example, on Leonardo? Because if you look at the Leonardo board, we can see that at least they had a provision for having a keypad. And the keypad was a smaller one, the one that's more like on the C sample, the 18-button keypad. So they had the smaller keypad, and they had a provision for the smaller 84 by 48 pixel LCD. And so especially if they were going to, at one point, we're thinking of making a Leonardo variant that would go into a little handset plastic case, then you would need to have UI firmware for those things. But did they ever have those things or not? It's a mystery. Because looking in official firmware, there is none of it. In official firmware, all of the code that supports UI peripherals, the code for the LCD, the code for the keypad, the code for battery charging, it's all D-sample. None of it is Leonardo, all D-sample. So for Leonardo, you can only do AT command configuration. So mystery, just mystery, mystery, mystery. Okay, so here we conclude with TI's own development boards. And we can move on to devices that were made by other players in the industry. So my first device, my first Calypso device was the OpenMoco. And of course, it's very obviously a derivative of Leonardo with very small changes. So the only really substantive change from Leonardo to OpenMoco was the reduction of bands from quad band down to tri-band. And in reducing the bands, they changed the design of the RF front end. So the original RFFE was this single component, the EPCOS M034F that was, you know, used on Leonardo. And but the FIC, they had their own RFFE that's different, was only tri-band. But what also matters is they have incompatible signals. So the control signals that go from the Calypso to the RFFE, they permuted them just a little bit. But the little permutation they made in the control signals makes them firmware incompatible. So it would be impossible to run the same firmware image on both FIC OpenMoco devices and Leonardo because of this permutation. So, which also makes it kind of strange because the world's one and only surviving copy of TCS211 firmware is the one recovered from the ruins of OpenMoco. And in this case, it was shipped to them. TI support division shipped them a firmware build that already was modified for the permuted RFFE control signals. So it's like, what, TI shipped a binary without even being able to test it on their own Leonardo board? Like, you know, what in the world? But yeah, so that's how it seems to have been. And again, more archaeological interests, like what did FIC make? What kind of devices did they make long before OpenMoco? Because when we look at the devices.txt file for Fluid, it has dates. There are comments in the file with dates in 2004. And furthermore, those 2004 dated comments correspond to the addition of flash device tables for the two chip selects. So if you look at the PCB layout of this OpenMoco device, the actual flash chip that was populated in mass-produced OpenMoco phones only has 4 megabytes. So you have a 4 megabyte flash chip populated, but the PCB footprint can accommodate larger flash. The PCB footprint can accommodate up to 16 megabyte flash chips. And in order to connect a 16 megabyte flash chip to Calypso, you have to use two chip selects, where one of them is fixed, is always NCS0. But for the second chip select, you can choose whichever one you want. And in the PCB wiring that exists in GTA 1 and GTA 2 PCBs, the second chip select is wired to Calypso NCS4. Again, it's not actually used because they have a 4 megabyte chip populated, but the wiring is there in the PCB. And when you look at those comments in fluiddevices.txt file, the comments are from 2004. But those 2004 comments are, and by the way, the devices.txt file, that comes from OpenMoco officially. But OpenMoco, even though they never released the source for the modified Fluid, they did publish a binary package, by binary meaning the binary for ARM Linux on OpenMoco processor. In that ARM Linux binary package, there is a devices.txt file because the file is necessary for it to work. And that's the file I'm referring to. So in that devices.txt file, there are comments from 2004 that add support for a 128 megabit or 16 megabyte flash chip that has a second chip select in the address space corresponding to NCS4, exactly like it is wired in the OpenMoco PCB. So what kind of devices were they making in year 2004 that had this giant flash connected to Calypso? Again, inquiring minds wants to know, historical mystery. So, yeah, and then also, like, you can read that later, you can read that part in the slide. So let's see, what do we have here? All right, so question by Harold, comment by Harold. They made some feature phones. I have one of them somewhere. Yes, yeah, I suspect that you probably have one, given that you worked for the company at one point. So it would be interesting to look at that part of history. More typing. Okay, no idea why they had the larger flashes in some models. Well, I mean, it might depend on functionality, because if they were feature phones, and if they were like really advanced feature phones, something comparable to, say, like a Pirelli DPL10 or Sony Ericsson K200, if it was comparable feature-wise to those, then of course the firmware complexity goes way up, and they probably needed the big flash, because the 16 megabyte flash they're talking about, that's what they have in those other ones. The Pirelli DPL10 has that arrangement, and the Sony Ericsson K200 has that arrangement. So if they were comparable feature-wise, then that would justify the large flash. But anyway, so with the Motorola. So these obviously are the most popular Calypso device choice for Smartcom community. Most people, you know, when they think Calypso, they think of these phones. When I was looking at them, when I took my very first look at these Motorola phones, was it year 2014, I think, the first thought that jumped to my mind is, how in the world did Compel's engineers convince their managers to give them the time allocation to just completely revamp the firmware? Because it was very obvious that they had a different taste. So TI's engineers had their own ideas about how the firmware should be structured. Compel's engineers very obviously had very strong opinions, and they were very different from TI's. And it is very, very heavily revamped. And again, all I can think is, you know, how did they convince their managers to give them all those hours to do that? That's a mystery that we'll probably never answer. But now, just to put it in context, it's not as heavily modified as TSM30. Now, if you want to see a phone where the firmware is completely, totally revamped beyond all recognition compared to TI, that's TSM30. You know, look at the TSM30 source. The first time I laid my eyes on that source back in 2011, I was going, oh my God. Yeah, the TSM30 source is just completely revamped beyond all recognition. Compel's version is not as heavily modified. Now, of course, we don't have source. We're just looking at the binary. But even just looking at the binary, you know, examining things. And there's one special firmware version for Motorola C115 family that came with a map file. You know, no source, of course. We don't even have a COF file, but we do have a .map file from the linker. And from that linker.map file, you can see where the sections are. And you can see which part of the code image came from which .obj file, and you have the symbol table. So that's very helpful for reverse engineering. So looking at all those things, you can see which parts they kept versus which parts that unchanged. And again, you know, you can read the slide later. But yeah, I'm just like, why did they make so many changes? And the hardware side, okay, so most of the revamping, of course, on the firmware. The firmware and also how they do calibration. How they do RF calibration, how the per unit factory data is stored is so completely different on Compel relative to TI. It's beyond recognition change. So those are, of course, the most obvious changes. If you don't care about that, if you're just looking at hardware, okay, well, in hardware terms, let's see. They made the flash brickable, which, of course, is a horrible pain. So they changed the wiring of the NA boot signal to disable the internal boot ROM and make the brickable flash. They used a different PA. They have different, you know, permuted RFFE control signals, okay. And they also have this really nonsensical wiring for the power button. So the red button on the keypad, the one that is both power and call hangup, the sane way to wire that button is it goes to a dedicated pin on the Yota ABB, because that's your power on mechanism. but and it does not form part of a regular matrix. So your regular matrix of rows and columns excludes that button. That button is not even there. But the way in which they wired it on the compile phones, it's double. So they still have that red button wired to the Yota chip's PWM pin. They have to, otherwise they wouldn't be able to turn the phone on. But in addition to this required wiring, they also, some really weird way, they have it factored into the regular rows and columns matrix. And again, a very, very hacky way I can't even describe properly. That just creates a royal pain for firmware to support it like that. Again, why did they do it? I don't know. And then, of course, the last paragraph on the slide, this is very much a matter of opinion. So when we have these two different ways of doing things, we have TI's original way of doing things, and we have Compel's very different way of doing things. Which of them are you going to call right? Which of them are you going to accept as your canon? So that's totally a matter of opinion. So, and as you can see, you know, Osmocom chose Compel's way, and I chose TI's way. So that's kind of what happened here. So, let's see. So, need a little bit more juice. So when I entered the scene, I basically saying, you know, certain historical facts. So OpenMocha was my primary device. I had a Neo Free Runner. That was my primary platform, the one, you know, I was doing all my work on. And then, you know, I had a PRDP L10 as my secondary device. And then I was playing a little bit with the Motorola C139. But they could never replace OpenMocha as primary. So, one thing, when I was showing all of the original development boards from, let's go back a few slides here. Let's go back a few slides to the D sample. So, yeah, because this board right here is the most canonical. This is what TI's own engineers used in the offices and cubicles and doing all their software work and whatnot. This was the Canon platform. So you can see there are two UARTs here. These are real, genuine RS-232 UARTs with level shifters, the whole bit, RS-232 positive, negative voltage swing. And so there are two. You have modem UART that had the AT commands. And then you had the IRDA UART that had the debug traits of ATmux interface. Everything was designed with the assumption that you have those two UARTs. That was the canonic. Of course, here, while we're looking at this sample, you know, this is where you connect JTAG. JTAG connects right here. And there are four buttons here. Of the four buttons, you have the power button, you have the reset button, and then the other two buttons duplicate. There's a button that duplicates the one button here, and there's a button that duplicates this green make call button. So they just duplicate what's on the keypad. So those aren't too important, really, but the important part is the two UARTs. The two UARTs was how you would interface with this thing. And so when I was playing with OpenMocha devices, on OpenMocha, you also had two UARTs. You had one UART going inside the device to the Linux processor, and you had the other UART going to the headset jack, and I was using both of those. So now try using Motorola C139 or PRDP L10, where you don't have both UARTs. Now suddenly I can't do things the same way how TI's original engineers did things. So that was very crippling to me. Plus, you know, all the other changes. Early on, I really wanted to be able to just, you know, the work that I had to do to deblob the firmware, transform it from blobs into source, that took a very, very long time. And so when I was in my early phases, I really wanted to be able to run the firmware without any changes, including the blobs. So, and I could only do that on the OpenMocha device. Couldn't do it on anything else. And so here, these are some of the practical issues I was facing. So when I was using the OpenMocha Neo Free Runner, if you think about the practicality of it, it would have the physical device. It has the USB port on one side, and it has the headset jack on the other side. Don't remember which is left, which is right, but they were opposite sides. And so I had to have both of those plugged in. I had to have the USB plugged in order to SSH into the Linux processor, because I had to be logged into the Linux side of the phone in order to be able to control the on-off signal for the Calypso chipset. The chipset won't even turn on without this on-off signal. So I had to have the on-off signal at least. And also, if I wanted to control audio, you had to run the also something commands there from Linux. And also, that was the only way to get to the modem UART. But then for the IRDA UART, I had to have the headset jack cable plugged in, which is the same way as on a Motorola. The same headset jack that's on Motorola C1XX, it's the same one as up on Mocha, so it's the same cable. But still, now I have two cables plugged in the device from opposite ends. And furthermore, if I want to test voice calls, I have to hold up to my ear, because the only available speaker is the very, very quiet earpiece. I can't use a loudspeaker when the headset check is used for just the way the pre-runner was wired, they're incompatible. And so I had to lift this whole arrangement up to my ear with cables plugged in from both ends. I mean, this is inconvenient to the max. And not to mention that the hardware was unobtainium. Nobody else had OpenMocha hardware. And so if I want to share my work with other people, well, they can't get the hardware. So this was basically the reason why I had to do FCDF3B. So the reason why FCDF3B was made was to solve the problems that are on this slide. That was the primary reason more than anything else. So yeah, so here, I explained how I did that. And the biggest problem that I had when I was doing FCDF3B, what I really wanted was Leonardo. So as I was mentioning previously, I searched the world high and low looking for a real TI-made Leonardo board. Couldn't find one. Then I was searching the world for the PCB design files, because if I could find the PCB layout file for Leonardo, I could just send the Gerbers to fab and have a non-working thing. No, could not find it, impossible, no matter how hard I looked. And I thought about, okay, hire a PCB layout engineer to recreate a new from scratch PCB layout based on Leonardo schematics. But the risk would be insanely high, because as I already mentioned before, Leonardo, there were so many different versions, I don't even know which one is right, if any of them. So plus my complete lack of knowledge about, this back then. Now I know it now, but back then I knew nothing about RFPCB layout for GSM phones. And so the level of risk would have been just astronomical. But thankfully, I was able to convince Sean Mospoulos, the founder of Unmoco. I convinced that fine gentleman to release the design files for OpenMoco GTA02. So they are public now, the schematics and layout files done in pads. And so the PCB layout of FCDF3B was derived from OpenMoco GTA02. And so that's why the 3B at the end of the 3B stands for tri-band. And there was an explicit step backward from me. At first, I wanted to make a Leonardo clone, but then I said, okay, well, it'd be an almost clone of Leonardo. FCDF3B is almost a Leonardo clone, except that it's tri-band because it's based on OpenMoco PCB layout. So that's how it came to be. And then, I did what I could to make it this feel as much as possible like TI. So the power connector, as I already mentioned, on FCDF3B is the exact same one as on C-sample and D-sample Leonardo. Same power connector. And again, I lifted the part number. So for Leonardo, we have several different schematics. And one of the schematics, they all have PDFs, but for one of them, we got not only PDF, but also the ORCAD DSN file, because the development board group at TI, they used ORCAD for schematics and pads for PCB layout. So we have the DSN ORCAD file which has component metadata for various components. And from the component metadata, I extracted the part number for that orange connector that goes on the PCB. So that's how that one came to be. And then the exact type of SIM socket on the board is the one that TI used. And the little push buttons for the power on the reset, I used the exact same part number that TI had on Leonardo in the component metadata. I really wanted to copy TI. So that's how that came to be. And let's see. And then, you know, we come to the more modern, more relevant stuff. And that is the Huawei GTM900. So the announcement was definitely a surprise, because at this point, the year was 2019. In year 2019, the number of people who care about GSM 2G was already very, very reduced. Almost nobody cared about the stuff anymore by then. And certainly almost nobody cared about Calypso. And out of the blue, out of nowhere, in May of 2019, there comes this comrade Song Bossi from China, who made posts on both mailing lists announcing the existence of this module, the GTM900. So, you know, I got a few of those modules, started examining them, started playing around. The first thing I noticed was it's very close to Leonardo OpenMoCA, and which was like actually a relief for me, because up until then, prior to May of 2019, I had not seen anyone else other than OpenMoCA just take, because, you know, OpenMoCA's version, what made it so attractive to me was, unlike everybody else, they made so few changes relative to TI. So Compal, Motorola C1XX, they just changed things left and right compared to TI. Pirelli DPL10, not as much, but also lots and lots of changes left and right. BenQ M32, oh, horrible. So everybody else that I had seen prior to May of 2019, they weren't satisfied with just keeping stuff from TI as is. They would just hack the wazoo out of it. But this Huawei GTM900, like, oh, breath of fresh air. This one is not as heavily modified compared to Leonardo. This is, you know, they kept things mostly unchanged on both hardware and firmware. So that was certainly interesting. Now, I mean, it is a kind of a poor, crippled module. So the first huge downside for me is that it only supports European bands. And, you know, I'm based in North America. Here, you know, we like to use 850 and 1900 bands. And there is a different version. There is GTM900-P, which supports North American bands, but it's like an obscure, rare version. And so, and you can't have the same hardware support both European and US. They have different hardware versions. And then, you know, the other things I mentioned here, you can read about later. So the module, it wasn't great. Like, yeah, it was nice to know that it exists. Nice to know that someone kept things mostly unchanged from TI, unlike Motorola, for example. But still, it wasn't all that great. You know, I'm certainly much more much happier with my own S50B at that point. But then we come to the next discovery. So this discovery, as you can probably tell from the chronology in the very first sentence, I had to keep it a little bit of a secret for almost a year. So I discovered it in December of 2019. Because of certain circumstances, I could not make it public until late 2020. Now, we all know that year 2020 was what they call in Latin, annus horribilis. I don't speak Latin, so my pronunciation is probably butchered, but at least that's how it's spelled. So we all know 2020 was annus horribilis for the whole world. But for me, there were some additional factors beyond just the obvious. And so because of all those factors, I was only able to make publicly disclose the existence of those modules toward the end, like September, October-ish of 2020. And these modules are really, really nice. So let me tell you how I discovered it, because that ties with its quality. As I mentioned before, I was searching the world high and low for a real Leonardo board. And because one of several things I wanted to do with a real TI-made Leonardo board, I wanted to hook up a real TI-made Leonardo board to my CMU200 RF test instrument and really examine how the MO034 RFFE, exactly how that thing performs. I really wanted to know. And so I was searching for a device that had the EPCOS D1016, which is another name for the MO34F. And that's how I found this module. So what's incredible about the iVAU TR-800 is it is the only commercial mass-produced Calypso device I could find that retained Leonardo's quad-band RFFE. So Leonardo, when they made their very first reference design for Calypso Yotarito chipset, they put a quad-band RFFE in there, but nobody kept it. Every major commercial manufacturer removed the quad-band RFFE and they replaced it with either a two-band design or a three-band design, but never a four-band. And for a long time, I had the concern. I wondered if maybe the quad-band design was poor. Because if all we had was schematics, if there was no physical board, no PCB layout file, all we had were schematics and an ancient marketing presentation. By the way, while we're on it, let's go back a few slides to where I had the photo here, where I had the picture of the Leonardo board. Yes, so in this photo, this component that I am highlighting, this component is the EPCOS D1016, also known as EPCOS MO34F. That is the quad-band RFFE. So we have this photograph that shows it being physically on the board, and we have schematics that show it on the board. But there was never, prior to the discovery of iVAU TR-800, we had no way of knowing if it actually worked well. So my concern was, well, maybe the RF performance with the front-end module was so poor that they had no choice but to remove it from the design and reduce down to a dual band or tri-band. That was the concern I had. And so that concern was only dispelled when I discovered the iVAU TR-800, because iVAU TR-800 miraculously has the component preserved. They still use that same EPCOS RFFE, and it is fully quad band. And of course, as soon as I got the modules on the development board, which I'll get to, the very first thing I did was hook it up to my CMU200 instrument and do thorough RF tests. And I was so happy when I saw that the RF performance of this RFFE is just as good as a tri-band mono FCFTB. When I saw it with my own eyes on CMU200, it was like such a breath of relief. Yes, it actually does work just as well. Until then, we had no way of knowing. And so that was the thing with this module. So, I mean, I liked it so much. I thought, oh, you know, this is such a wonderful module that I actually went through the extra mile to have it reverse engineered. So I sent some sacrificial pieces of this module to a professional PCB reverse engineering company, and I paid them out of my own pocket to have it reversed. And the result of the PCB reversing is published. Everybody can download it. So the Gerber files, if you download the Gerber files and look at them, if you weren't told that these files came from reverse engineering, you would never know. Look at the Gerber files. It looks like you look at the original design. That's how good of a job the reverse engineering company did. And it's a six-layer PCB. And yeah, we got the whole thing reversed. And so once I got it reversed and it fully reconstructed, and we also have reconstructed netlist. So I have a netlist in my own PCB design language, text-based, that exactly corresponds to this module. So now that we have design basically recovered, we can support it properly. I can treat it as if it was an original FreeCalypso product. So that's basically added it to the family. And this is the inside. So as soon as, you know, the way this photo was produced, this one is not from a presentation. This one I actually made myself. The way I made this photo, I took the module and lifted off the shield can. So here, this part was covered by a metal shield can. But the shield can, you can lift the cover off without having to solder. So this piece right here, the metal structures that you see here, these are soldered to the PCB, but then there is a lid that goes on top of it, and that one you can just pop off. So I popped off the lid and I straightened out and I bent these pins. So these pins that you see here bent to the sides in a proper, you know, non-hacked module, they stick out perpendicular to the board surface and they're necessary for grounding. So the current return path. But here, you know, I bent them to the side and I put the module down on the glass of an office copier machine and used the scanner features. So that's how this picture was made. And you can see, you know, the raw image I posted publicly on my site. So as soon as I lifted that shield can, the first time I looked at it inside, it was immediately obvious that this right here, like from this corner to this corner, this is Leonardo. The component layout here exactly matches the component placement from that Leonardo component placement drawing we have from TI. So the only thing they added, they added this connector. And this is an 80-pin connector. So the signals that they bring out are so rich. They bring out not only all the signals that you could possibly need in the modem, but you could almost build a complete phone handset with this module because the Calypso memory bus is brought out. So you could hook up a parallel LCD. The keypad is brought out. There's so much brought out. So it's like a really, really awesome module. Such a nice discovery. And they had a corresponding development board. So this development board that you see here, the picture of this board, there are only two in the world. I have one of them, and one of my very, very close friends in Ficalypsa has the other. These were the only two boards in the entire world we could find. And so here you can see the modules. This is how the module sits on the PCB. So it's a permanent attachment, because basically what you have here is you have the 80-pin board-to-board connector, but you also have those four metal pins that go through the boards. So you have to have plated through holes or plated slots. And those four grounding legs, they go through the PCB and you have to solder them. Those are mandatory, because if you don't solder those pins, you won't be able to transmit GSM bursts, because you have on the 80-pin connector, you have five power pins, but you only have one ground pin. And so if you're doing TX bursts at full power, there is no way that one ground pin will be able to carry power supply return current. So you have to solder the grounding legs. And this is how they bring out the RF. So there is this little tiny, this little guy here, this U.FL compatible connector. So you have to have a micro coaxial cable from here, you know, carry your RF somewhere. So this is how they did it. They carry it to another one, and then they have a little trace on the PCB. And I don't know if they made the PCB, if they actually fabbed the PCB with controlled impedances for this little trace, or if they did it without controlled impedance and just hoped, you know, I don't know. But, you know, this is the board. And here they bring out on these pins, they bring out all of the extra signals that are brought out on that 80-pin connector, your memory bus, your I2C, your keypad signals, the whole bit is brought out. But when I first saw this board, it was so obvious to me that it was inspired by D-Sample. Because look, the two UARTs, the way the two UARTs are brought out is RS-232, just like D-Sample. And then furthermore, the thing that really drove it to me, and also on one of the UARTs, on the modem UART, you have modem control signals, which are on GPIOs. And the choice of specific GPIOs they use for modem control signals is exactly the same as on D-Sample. They obviously copied it from there. And also these four buttons. So why four? Why not two? Remember how on the D-Sample picture, there were also four buttons, how you had the power on button and the reset button with the boot controls, but you also had a one button and a call button, which correspond to basically, like, you know, they correspond to the one and the green button. So, and they are exactly like this. They're wired the same way as they are on D-Sample, the exact same row and column combinations. So it was just very, very obviously inspired by that. So this was, you know, the iWOW development board. Yeah, we're almost done. So what is available today? What are the boards you can actually get? So the one I just showed, there are only two of them in the world, so I can't get that one. So what is available? We have FCDFDB, you know, and we have Caramel 2. Those are mine, but, you know, all the usual issues there. But, you know, I can cover here. I've been told that there will be a Sysmocom board that's covered in the, you know, OS, what is it, tickets 4030, and going to be based on GTM 900. Now, the difference from GTM 900 to iWOW TR800, it's really not that big. I mean, I prefer TR800, I consider it better. But, you know, if someone wants to use GTM 900, not that big of a difference, aside from, of course, the obvious regional thing that won't work in North America. But the other real issue is that whichever module you use, whether you are using the GTM 900 or the iWOW module, either way, when you design the development board, it is unfortunately very easy to design in such a way that it'll be just perfectly fine for SmartComDB, but basically useless for more TI style development. So that was kind of, you know, the last paragraph here. So, you know, why did I spend insane amounts of money producing first FCDFDB, then Caramel 2 and the whole bit? You know, why not just use Motorola C1XX phones? Because for most people, at least on the SmartComDB side, the Motorola C1XX phones are perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with the Motorola C1XX phone if all you want to do is run OBB. But, you know, for basically the two projects have asymmetric hardware requirements. Any hardware that's made for FreeCalypso can trivially run on SmartComDB, but not the other way around. So that's kind of the board situation. And so now here on this slide, I cover one of my really, really ambitious goals. So this goal that's depicted on this slide, I was ready to start working on it at the end of 21, beginning of 22. But then I got sidetracked by political developments in USA. Because unfortunately, the evil corporate owners of T-Mobile USA are killing GSM, and they're killing 2G. And so when that policy became plainly obvious in early 2022, that was when I had to completely set this work aside and switch my attention to the network side of GSM, working with SmartCom CNI software and Themyscira Wireless, all of that. But before I made that switch of gears, this was what I wanted to work on. This was my personal dream. So I wanted to recreate a board that would be just like dSample, but can run current firmware. So dSample was this holy, you know, the mother of all boards back inside TI. It had the giant LCD, it had the keypad, it had the magnetic buzzer, it had everything that you would want. And I even have a real dSample board. I can't do anything with it because, one, I have no schematics, and two, I don't have the TPU DRV10.c file. And so I wanted to make a new board that would have Calypso Yota Rita chipset, Rita, not Clara, so we could run our own firmware, but still have that same giant LCD. And so as I'm discovering here, I made back in 2020, back in Annus Horribilis, when, you know, my day job was converted to 100% remote with COVID, you know, I was just stuck sitting here. One of the things I was able to do was I was able to put together this hack using this board that, you know, depicted two slides ago. Using this board right here, you know, I got my friends at Technotronics to desolder this weird thing, whatever this thing is, and populate a standard header in there. So I had standard headers populated. And then I would connect my own external LCD. So it was relatively easy to find new currently made LCDs that are of the same size and interface as the one used on D-sample, because thankfully it's one of the industry standard sizes, one of the industry standard interface options. So I hooked up the LCD to this. I hooked up a 5x5 keypad board. And so in 2020, while sitting here in the COVIDian lockdown, I was able to create this platform that was called FreeCalypso Luna, which, you know, it worked. It's a complete mess in physical arrangement because I had all these multiple boards assembled on my lab bench, interconnected with ribbon cables. It's worse than a rat's nest. But, you know, it worked well enough until I said, okay, I mean, this is just too messy. And then I wanted to add the buzzer, because the original D-sample has a magnetic buzzer and the firmware is written with the assumption that it's there. But it's impossible to hook it up to the TR-800 because that signal is not brought out on the module. And so I think, okay, well, maybe just bite the bullet. Make the board the hard way, the same way how I did FC3B, just from chips. Build the board the hard way and totally custom PCB and hook everything up, you know, make it a, you know, D-sample-like. So that's what I wanted to do. But then again, I got sidetracked. You know, now I'm working on the network side of GSM. But maybe if I live long enough, you know, if I outlive everybody else because I'm pure blood or whatever, maybe I'll get back to making this board at some point. Who knows? So that's just a distant dream that I have. And now, you know, this is the final slide that I have is, you know, engaging the community. And okay, at this point, I'm basically out of breath. So I'll let you just read the slide and maybe start asking questions because it is the last slide while I take a breather and some juice. Okay, I'm going to step for a little bit from the laptop. I need to give myself more juice. So, did I bore everybody to death? All right, nope, okay, well. Ah, the long one. I've had to talk for this long straight a long time.
So this is the slide. Thanks for sharing all your input regarding the feedback on additional hardware designs and so on. I think I personally think the remaining lifetime of GSM is rather limited, and designing additional boards is not really, particularly designing complex boards from scratch using raw chips, as you put it, is a lot of time investment, and that's probably more, more productive or more useful ways of putting all that energy for the GTM 900 breakout that we are doing. And I think we have the first prototype arriving or something like that these days. It's mainly because we have lots of those GTM 900 modules that I bought some years ago, and it makes sense to put them to use other than putting them to trash. But that's really the only reason for doing that. We can put those modules to use, and you need a carrier for the module, of course.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So basically, a few comments here. So first of all, on the terminology. So the board that you're doing in project in OS number 4030, I know you call it GTM 900 breakout, but I kind of disagree with the term breakout, because the term breakout assumes neutrality. So if you would just bring out every signal from that module without imposing a particular philosophy, then you could call it a breakout. But it's really more of an application board, I call it, because there are certain design choices there that make essentially an OBB only board. The way, if that board were to be physically produced and put in a web shop, everybody who wants to play with SmartCombB will certainly be very happy because it's good enough for that purpose. But anyone who wants to play with FreeCalypso will find that board we'll find it unusable, basically. So yeah, the question, okay, if open to improving the naming, well, call it SmartCombB development board or something, maybe to realistically reflect what it is. So basically, the way the design stands, as the design stands currently, it is an OBB-only board, which, if that's what you want, that's what you want. But, I'm looking at, okay, so if there is going to be an OBB-only board that's going to hit the web shop and will become available to the general public, presumably at a somewhat low price, but it's non-FC capable, well, that kind of hurts my pride and everything. So the entire reason why I'm thinking of producing an alternative board is only because of that. If Project OS 4030 did not exist, then I wouldn't be thinking about doing an alternative. Now, to be clear, the Venus board design, the one that's from chips and everything, that's for my own personal happiness. I don't think that board will ever be used, but I think there will be a total of three people in the world who will get the Venus board. It'll be me, it'll be the Signal, and maybe Vadim. So those three will be the only three people in the world who will likely have an interest in the Venus board. And of course, they'll all get it for free. the cost will be on me only. But when it comes to this other proposal, the proposal that's on the screen right now, this is separate from Venus. This proposal is strictly in response to the existence of OS 4030 design. Thinking, okay, well, how can I produce something that's going to be as cheap as OS 4030 or as close as possible to that, but in about same class, about same category, but just different enough to where it can run both firmwares? That's really what.
Maybe we can first ask in general if there are questions before we go into this very detailed discussion. Maybe there are other topics or other questions, comments on the,
yes, please.
The large part of the talk.
Does the firm include DSP code? Unfortunately not. Okay, so this is actually a very good question because it really ties into the core of which part TI consider to be most valuable. From what I could tell, in TI's worldview back in those days, they considered the DSP to be the most valuable component of the whole thing, which also makes sense because that's what they started with. When it all began as a relation between Nokia and TI, the thing that TI brought to the table was the DSP. Everything else, you know, the protocol stack, the layers 2 and 3, that came from Condat, which used to be a separate company, which TI bought out in 2002. But TI's main thing was the DSP. And so in all of the mass-produced chipsets, the DSP is in the ROM. The DSP is in the ROM. And furthermore, they try to write to read protect the ROM. They try to make it difficult to read the ROM out. Now, thankfully, the Sylvain found a way to bypass the ROM read protection and read out a dump of the ROM, and the dumps are published on the FTP site. On my FTP site, you can find dumps of DSP ROM 3311, 3416, 3606. But of course, these are raw hex dumps. Then there is a Python script somewhere in the SmartCommonDB repository that converts this ASCII text dump hex into a COF file. And a COF file is what you can then load into IDEA or other tools. So basically, it'd be a massive reverse engineering job. And the firmware has patches. So most of the code is in the ROM. But TI, because you know so expensive to make a chip modification, TI allowed an escape hatch. The code, the DSP code that's in the ROM, it's structured in such a way as to make it easy to override functions. So I haven't dug that deep with my own disassembly, but when Sylvain was covering this topic a while back, he was saying that in a DSP, most of the function calls are made through a table. So they have a table of pointers to functions, which is initialized by the ROM. And almost any time, you know, there's a major functionality invoked, the function calls are made through this table of function pointers. And so when you download a patch, the patch can selectively replace individual parts of functionality and override those pointers. Now, you can't replace the whole thing because of space limitations, because the complete code, the complete DSP image, the DSP ROM is 128K words. Now, the reason why you do everything in words and not bytes is the DSP architecture is not byte addressable. The smallest addressable unit in the DSP is a 16-bit word. So when the address increments by 1, that's 16 bits, not 8. And so there's 128K words of mask ROM, but you only have 28 or so K words of RAM. So there just isn't enough RAM to replace the entire body of the DSP ROM with patches. So when you have patches, you have to be selective. You have to know the original code, whether through source or through extended disassembly. And you say, okay, most of it is good, but there's this one function here that has a bug. And so I'm going to replace this one function with the download patch, and I'm going to patch the table of function pointers so that my version gets called instead. So that's how the patches work. And the patches are supplied with the firmware. But once again, the patches are binary. So recovering the DSP, recovering the source for the DSP ROM is a major, major, major dream of mine. I don't know if it still exists. So it is an unknown. You know, possibility one, there may be a corporate archive somewhere at TI. Maybe TI has some deep corporate archives, and somewhere there is a copy buried very deeply of the DSP source. Or possibility two, it might not exist at all. It's possible that it's been lost to all of humanity, just like, you know, those 50,000 clay tablets stolen from Baghdad Museum in 2003. So we just don't know, but it's one of my big dreams to recover the DSP source. Okay, let's see. Thanks a lot. Can't imagine they just threw all those valuable secrets into the trash bin. Well, at least they made it look like it. So whether or not they actually threw it all in the trash, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but they sure made it look like they did. That's the answer to the comment.
Well, the question is also how valuable you would consider those. I mean, if you think in the context of those companies, how valuable was a 2G only baseband DSP code in 2012 or whenever they shut down this entire division after losing probably, I don't know, hundreds of millions of euros previously going downhill. So how valuable would that have been? And also at that time, all kinds of baseband chip manufacturers were closing down. It was also the time when first ST Microelectronics merged their baseband with, what was it, Ericsson mobile platforms. And then they merged again with NXP. And then finally they closed down. So you can find a number of different 2G baseband chipset manufacturers that ceased to exist, and that clearly means that it wasn't really that valuable from a business point of view what they had.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at it from an archaeological point of view, history preservation. I mean, if there is going to be any kind of, like, you know, nuclear World War III or something, the civilization is going to ruin, as soon as the radiation clears, I'll be traveling to the ruins of Nice and putting on a radiation suit and digging through the rubble looking for this DSP source code.
No, I'm not saying it's not useful or it's not important in that kind of context. I was just responding to the statement in the chat that it's valuable.
Yeah.
I'm you know, to like commercially, it was not valuable at that time, or not at least not.
For sure.
You won't find anything at the TI Nice site. There's now a company called Amadeus, and the only thing that it reminds of TI is the road name Jack Kilby, Avenue Jack Kilby.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Of course, you know, some people say that maybe there could be corporate archives at the Dallas headquarters. You know, that's also a big unknown, because of course the world headquarters of Texas Instruments are in Dallas, Texas, and you know, at one point more than 20 years ago, I actually worked my first day job not that far from them, back when I lived in Dallas. But as far as I can tell, they were never involved in GSM business. So when the business was closed down, did they? Because I mean, if it's all digital, if the archive materials were all just files on a disk or a tape somewhere, did they send a copy of the tape to Dallas? Could it be in some archive in Dallas? I don't know. Maybe there is a tape somewhere. Maybe there isn't. All right, let me read the comment. Yeah. Many thanks for this presentation in regards to knowledge preservation. Is there a project or a website that would preserve all the knowledge that is brought by FreeCalypso or SmartCom on specification to the source code? I mean, that is certainly a valid question. So, I mean, right now, you know, I and a good friend of mine operate the server. So, I mean, we're just, you know, it's paid out of personal funds, the cost of renting the FreeCalypso.org server and everything that's on it. And yeah, I mean, I have backups. So if something were to happen to the FreeCalypso.org server, there is a backup. But of course, the worst question is, what if something happens to the humans who are on the server? That would be a much bigger problem. And of course, you know, the biggest enemy we have is, unfortunately, most of the world worships copyrights. Most of the world are unwilling to be lawbreakers. So people are just so hesitant to post materials in direct defiance of copyright. And I'm one of the very, very few people in the world who are just willing to do it boldly and openly. So that's really the biggest problem with preservation is anyone can copy. Anyone can do a mirror of recopilator.org. If you want rsync access, we can give you rsync access. That's the easy part. Question is, would there be anyone willing to do it?
I would guess your best chance of long-term archival is to upload stuff to archive.org.
Okay, so that's something to look into. Yeah, I know the site exists, but I don't know how they feel about copyrights and what to be involved.
Well, yeah, do some research, and then you will find out how they feel about copyright.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, topic for research. Okay.
But you can find, I mean, just let me put it like this, you can find tons of copyrighted materials, including ISO images of proprietary operating systems and whatnot on archive.org. So there's lots of precedent of not just archiving texts or whatever, but textual information, but even ISO images and stuff like that.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good.
And I think they're even located in California.
Oh, interesting. Interesting, yeah. I wonder if they are they perhaps around under the auspices of University of California, something like that, because I know, totally not a lawyer and nothing like that, but I've heard that entities that are affiliated with state governments can get away with things that private entities can't, and the University of California is actually a branch of California government, the state I'm in. So again, because I'm totally not a lawyer, nothing lawyer-like, I don't know any details, but I've heard that at the University of California, they have done similar things. That's like, look, we are state government, we can do things that private corporations can't easily get away with. So I wonder if archive.org is associated with them. Yeah, I'll dig, I'll look. Okay, 501c3, okay. Yeah, but the question is, are they associated with the government entity or not? University of California counts as